Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back senior ETF analyst for Bloomberg, Eric Balchunas. Eric, thanks for joining us again.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Eric, we have records broken across the board, Bitcoin ETFs. One of the ones that stood out to me most was the record number of days of inflows for BlackRock's. So I was wondering if you could give us your thoughts on this specific record of the number of days consecutively of inflows into IBIT.
Yeah, I think it ended at like 72 straight days, which is wild. I mean, that ranks it, I don't know, seventh, eighth all time, but it was the biggest active streak for a long time. And so if you look at new ETFs, that's never happened. So it's just so such an anomaly. The number I like to look at that I think really truly shows you how weird this is IBIT reached $10 billion in 49 days. Now, the record for the speed to reach $10 billion before that was 647 days. So think about how much that blows away the record. So it's the inflow streak was really interesting because day in and day out, it's hard to take money in every day. ETFs are like hotels. People like to come in and out. So taking money every day is really unusual. But to get to $10 billion in 49 days is just absurd. So I am used to absurdity now. It's almost like absurd and unreal has become the norm in this category. So this is why I pretty much hard to stop me being obsessed with it because I've been covering this stuff for like 20 years. And, you know, when the currency hedge boom happened, I was stuck on that for a while. ARK was a big deal. And then through it all, Vanguard is always fascinating. But this is right up there in terms of things that have fascinated me over the years.
The Bitcoin Layer is very proud to be sponsored by River, a Bitcoin-only exchange and who we believe to be the leader in the business. Go check them out today at river.com/TBL for a special offer of up to $100 of Bitcoin for free when you go sign up. You have a lot of options when it comes to buying Bitcoin. We believe River is your best choice because they do not custody your Bitcoin on a third-party exchange. They have their own solution for storage, and they encourage you to get your coins off the exchange as soon as possible. River.com/TBL for that special offer. Incredible. So tell us then about you mentioned Vanguard. We have a shift in leadership at Vanguard. It's a move that you actually predicted. So walk us through that.
Yeah. So this guy, Salim Ramji, who I've gotten to know over the years, was the global head of ETFs at BlackRock. So of course, our worlds would collide. He was on ETF IQ. He was on our podcast. I interviewed him for my book called The Bogle Effect, all while he was at BlackRock. And great guy, real student of indexing. Really, he's very Vanguardian at heart. So I'm not surprised they hired him because when they interviewed him, I know he has the experience, but I bet he won over their hearts with his knowledge of indexing and his passion for low cost investing and whatnot. But it was weird because Vanguard's 49 years old and they've never had an outsider CEO. Every other one has come internally and almost every one of them has also been an assistant to Jack Bogle. So this would be a departure from that big time. I don't think people think like this has something to do with Vanguard not doing Bitcoin. I don't think there's any connection there, but I will say Salim is not a fan, but he's into Bitcoin and blockchain. He oversaw the filing of IBIT and the launch. And when the launch came out, he went on LinkedIn and said, I love that this is ETFs are great at providing access to new frontiers of investing. So he calls it a new frontier. And so it's going to be interesting. There's many things that I'm looking at in terms of what he'll do or how he'll make Vanguard different. One of those is their stance on crypto. I would look for reversing the crypto ban on their platform first, maybe in a year or two. I wouldn't look for a Vanguard Bitcoin ETF anytime soon. The thing about that is BlackRock already, by coming in at 20, 25 basis points as a fee, like, they kind of already vanguarded the category. I'm not sure Vanguard could add much. Maybe they come in at 15, but I think by the time you might have a Schwab come out in the next year or two, we could already be at 10 to 15 basis points anyway. But I do see Vanguard maybe opening up and lightening up a little on their general outlook. Like, clearly they are anti. I think they'll probably slowly undo the anti. I don't know if they'll be advocates or cheerleaders, but I just see them being more relaxed about it because of his influence. And I would call that an incremental change, not like a radical change.
But it is important to flag. We have Vanguard coming out with a vehement anti-crypto, anti-Bitcoin stance upon the launch of Bitcoin ETFs and their approval. And then we saw a big public backlash. And we don't know necessarily how much it hit Vanguard's business at the end. Maybe you could give us any insight there. But what we do know is from a PR perspective, it didn't go well that they had an anti-Bitcoin stance. Now they've hired someone who was directly involved in the launch of IBIT.
Yeah, like, I don't think those things are connected. I could see, I know, you know, the Bitcoin crowd gets very excited and I could see why they would connect it, but I don't think there is one. Maybe someday we'll find out for sure, but that's tough inside information to get. But anyway, I will say that, you know, if you're Vanguard, I don't really think you're bothered. I mean, you know, right now ETFs this year have taken in $272 billion. And Vanguard's taken in $95 billion of that. Like, so what is that? Like maybe a third almost? That's pretty damn good. I mean, remember, there's 600 issuers. So Vanguard alone takes 33% of all the flows. They're not hurting. You know, with Vanguard, the fish jump in the boat. That's how good, trusted and they are. Also, the typical Vanguard investor probably isn't going to be into Bitcoin, I think. I think they're just classic 60-40ers. That said, I think there's some that may understand the dollar is being devalued or they want something to help their real return. I could see some being open. And personally, I just don't think Vanguard should be playing like nanny. You know, I just think, well, you know, your investors are smart. They obviously found Vanguard at low cost. Typically, if you find a Vanguard ETF, you're probably a heads up investor. So you're probably mature enough to make your own decisions. So I just think, what I don't like is I just think it like insults the intelligence of their own investors. I just believe in freedom of choice. So, and they let the gold ETFs on the platform, which you could argue are the same thing, less volatile, but the similar concept. So I feel like they're not worried about it. But like I said, I think over time, maybe they, you know, maybe it will worry them because I will say IBIT is the second leading ETF in flows this year. Vanguard is number one, but like, you know, in other words, the IBIT has taken in more money than every other Vanguard ETF besides VU. So that's everybody in the industry has noticed this. This is a big deal. This is a massive moment. But Vanguard just isn't quite the company to get jealous. Typically, like they are they're owned by their own investors, which makes them mutually owned, almost like a co-op. So they're not really playing the same game as these other like, hey, let's make all the revenue we can companies. But over time, I think as they grow their wealth management business, because they have this advisory service, as that gets bigger and you're trying to manage money for your, let's say a 65-year-old, and they've got stocks, they've got bonds. I mean, now through Vanguard, you get private equity. I think crypto or a Bitcoin could fit in there with gold. So I think if you're going to service somebody fully as an advisor, which Vanguard does, I think you're just going to have access to crypto. Doesn't mean you have to launch one or cheerlead for it, but you know, I just think if they're going to keep telling people, no, we will not do that because we know it's best for you. I think you just could just, there's no point. It just irritates people for no reason. So that's where things stand. And because Salim is obviously, you know, he advocated for the launch of the Bitcoin ETFs. I just think that that will lighten up.
I don't think people fully understand, Eric, the significance of IBIT being the second largest ETF by inflows this year in 2024. And the leading one is basically the Vanguard all stock market, or one of their largest catch-all for equities around the world. Talk to us just about, you said like that you are obsessed with this new wave of ETFs because it is so unprecedented in its flow. Just talk to us, just give us that big picture view of how serious it is for you as an observer to see Bitcoin, a single Bitcoin ETF be the second largest out of every single ETF in the world offered in American public markets. Sorry.
It's bizarre. I mean, look, the top 10 year-to-date flows is always a list occupied by like blue blood, you know, core stuff, S&P 500, Barclays aggregate bond ETFs, total market ETFs. Occasionally you get a little bit of a freak up there. Like 1 year, like when I referenced currency hedging, DXJ, which is goes long Japan and then hedges out the currency, that thing was on fire in 2012 and it was like number one or two that year. So every now and then you get something out of the ordinary, but never, ever have you had somebody that's new. It's just never happened. So for IBIT to be 15.5 billion in flows, which ranks it second, is weird. And then by the way, FBTC is Fidelity's, that's ranked seventh. So you've got two of the Bitcoin ETFs in the top 10. That's crazy. So if you looked at all of the class of 2024, which would be ETFs launched this year, obviously these blow, they're like 100 times more than anybody. But just the fact that they're blowing away 99.9% of the rest of ETFs too is weird. Now, granted, GBTC is on the flip side of that list. So maybe some of these flows came from GBTC. I would reckon maybe 40%. But even if you remove that 40%, it's still remarkable. Remember, if you get $100 million in your first year as an ETF, you're successful. So think about it. That's how hard the ETF business is. So I try to tell people that. And then the stat that I find interesting is if you take BlackRock global ETF business, they have 1,034 ETFs. IBIT has taken in more than any of them. And it's accounted for 17% of all of BlackRock's global flows. Again, that's weird for one ETF to be that big of a deal. And it's certainly weird for it to be a newborn. So again, these are all just very strange things that have never happened before and probably won't happen again.
Eric, I want to go back to a chart that you put out a couple days ago, recapping the flows on a daily basis of each ETF. But then you have on this bottom pane a nice netted flow chart here to just show, instead of looking individually, we just have everything netted out. So I was wondering if you could give us your take on the evolution of flows. Obviously, a huge wave of inflows at the beginning, GBTC pressure then driving the net amount negative on some of these days. So bring us up to speed. Any updated thoughts on GBTC as well, as those flows look like they've come to a minimum now?
Yeah, so GBTC bleeding less or even some days taking in flows has really helped. The other ones have cooled off a little too. So in essence, there's more of a normalization on both sides. But it seems to me there's been like three stages. Like, so there was the initial flow of day one through day five. Understandable. All the hype. That wouldn't surprise me. Then there was a little outflows. Maybe some friends and family that came in the first days were like, hey, look, I did my job. I'm going to move my money now. I don't know. But there was a little bit of outflows like the second week. And then I thought, okay, we're going to just kind of hang at this like couple billion dollars. This is where I thought the first few months would go. But then boom, this like second wind happened that is unusual. And all of a sudden they started taking in like 300 million a day, 500 million a day. I think 1 billion net came in one day. And boom, you know, all of a sudden the net flows were 12.5 billion. I was like, wow. I mean, that was my prediction for all the flows for a year. And they already got there in like 2.5 months. But then the price struggled. It went down. I think the flows and the ETFs are kind of like in a tango. I don't know exactly which one's dictating which. I tend to think that sometimes the ETF flows come in, the price starts to go. And then I do think there's Bitcoin natives or leverage flushes or whatever you guys say, that the price, I'm telling you, the flows will come in 2-3 straight days, but then the price goes down anyway. And so I do think there's people taking profits or getting out. Maybe it's a trade. I don't know, but I think the ETFs are largely innocent. I do think, though, once the price starts to go down, it starts to go into a decline of like 10%, 12%. You have a couple people on the very outskirts that will leave the ETF because they're just short term. So after the second win, there was some outflows, maybe I think about 1.5 billion over like a month or something like that. Not too crazy. maybe 3 or 4% of total assets. So 95% of the people hung in there in the first correction we had, which I think is good. I've always said these boomers are going to be more diamond hands than people think. And I would say 95, 96% in the first test is pretty damn good. Then the price recovered. I think it went down to 50s. Now when it crossed 60, the flows have started to come back in. They've now in May totally offset the negative flows in April. And so we're now back to that 12.5 high water mark of the net flows. That number to me is the most important number to watch. That is net of everything. You know, the golf PGA is going on now. It's sort of like, you know, whatever the leader is -7. That's the course, the number of he's going to par some, bogey some, and birdie some, but then that his score is going to be net of all that. So plus 12.5 to me is the number to watch. Where will that end up? Again, my prediction is 15 billion. We'll see. It could be more, but again, it could be less. And so that's why that number will, and there'll be outflow periods and there'll be inflow periods. But I tell people, you know, there was the first day ARK saw one day of outflows after like 60 days of inflows. And this guy was like, what the fuck? What the F? Kathy Wood sucks. And I'm like, wait a sec, dude, honestly, like, are you that like childish? You don't realize that like this day of outflows represents 0.5% of the assets this fund has accumulated. I don't think they really understand that like ETFs are hotels. Picture a bustling lobby. These are traders. They come in and out. That's inflows, outflows. But upstairs, there's all these people doing nothing. They're in their room sleeping, and the two people don't bother each other. This is how ETFs work. So you're going to see inflows and outflows that correlates with the price a little, but it shouldn't be more than 1, 2, 3% of the total enchilada. So until you see like outflows representing 10, 20% of the assets, there's no it's over or we're back. I think you just have to chill. And I think what you need to do is just sort of keep your eye on the prize, which is the 12.5 billion number. And that number, even through April, you know, I don't think it got below 11. It was pretty steady. So in the end, I think sometimes the emotion of the crypto Twitter, some people, seems to be so dependent on like the inflows from the ETFs every day. One, it's there, you know, don't get too low on the outflows and don't get too high on the inflows. That's what I would say. Number two, you got to find a new narrative. I think, yes, the ETFs are a big deal, but they're out and they're only a vehicle. I think the Bitcoiners should like now focus on other narratives that are important for Bitcoin. What does it do? What does it cause? Like bigger picture stuff. I wouldn't just look at ETFs as the whole story, the whole catalyst. That's sort of like a snake eating its own tail. You can't, ETFs are just a vehicle. Just getting good access obviously was great. We saw all this money come in, people prefer ETFs, but you got to go plant into people's hearts and minds why they want to be in the first place. And I find that this is a good time to now pivot. Accept the ETFs are out there, accept that they're probably going to have in days, out days, but over time probably grow. And let's focus on other narratives that are important for crypto. And then the ETFs will take care of themselves. But if you're just sitting here and like waiting and you just think like the only thing that Bitcoin has going for it is that boomers are going to buy the ETFs, I just think at some point you'll get let down.
Yes, we fully agree with that. The ETFs are they're just a vehicle. They do, however, give certain institutional bodies around the world access and credibility to this new asset class that they didn't have previously. So we do expect a lot of the inflows from, let's say, a sovereign wealth fund, for example, to come in via American regulated ETFs like IBIT. So we'll continue to watch the inflows. We love your hotel analogy. And I guess the thinking big picture about Bitcoin is how big the hotel can get over time is really what, how many people want to stay there long term over time. And that will not come because there's an ETF that exists. It will only come because people want to own Bitcoin because it is a non-government, non-banking liability currency.
I forget who said it. It was this retail guy. it wasn't like, it was just a guy who likes Bitcoin. It wasn't like one of the famous Bitcoiners or anything, but he said it's the Second Amendment of money. To me, that resonates a lot, because if you look at the dollar, it's devalued. So to me, that is enough for most people. Okay, I get it. This protects me against my own government messing with the currency and devaluing it. Not that I'm, you know, I know Second Amendment can have like political implications, but the whole point is that the founding fathers wanted protections against the government because they didn't trust their own government. So you could be pro these amendments and pro that attitude while still liking where you live in your government, but you realize there's so many incentives to like devalue the dollar. It's politically expedient a lot of times. I get it. And it can even help make downturns in the market and the economy better. So it's not like all bad, but let's face it, the dollar has devalued. So to me, that's a very, very compelling argument crystallized into a few words. And I think that's ultimately going to win over people, not just, oh, now there's an ETF. There was a, I will say though, the ETF is so powerful as a vehicle. So the Bitcoin has now been put into the best possible delivery mechanism that exists on Earth, in my opinion. This reminds me of somebody who was like talking about Amazon, and they go, I decided to stop my Amazon membership and I just got off Amazon and I found I consumed half as much shit. I bought half as much stuff. They realized they just, because it was so easy and so frictionless to just go boom, boom and buy, that they bought more. ETFs probably have a little of that effect. They're so easy, so frictionless, so cheap, that you will find that even people who were moderately into it could bite. So that's good news. But I think overall, there's got to be a longer term narrative attached to it. And I know there is. I just think the ETF kind of like devoured the media cycle for several months.
Now that we're into May, Eric, we have disclosures coming out on ownership of these vehicles. Some extremely fascinating headlines that are popping out of them. Let's start with just the sheer number of holders that are in these public disclosures now. iBit with over 400. Talk to us about your impressions, the pure number of holders that are coming out. We're getting it from two places. We're getting it from the 13Fs individually, and then we're also getting it from the Bloomberg screen of the holders themselves.
Yeah. So just so people know, a 13F is when you have over $100 million in equity investments, which is pretty big, right? How many people can say that? And equity could include ETFs too. So ETFs plus stocks. If you have over $100 million in that, you need to file a 13F. And so 13Fs tell you what the pros are doing. You know, the people who, you know, live and breathe the market. So they give you insight into like, you know, how much this ETF is being used by pros and what kind of pros and how long they've held it and whatnot. So the first batch of 13Fs, normally for an ETF, you see one or two. Because remember, the ETF just getting started. Retail is the easiest fish to catch. They're like minnows. You throw a hook in the pond, you're going to get minnows first. It's hard to get the big fish coming out from the shadows. So the fact that you've got these big fish already biting is a good sign. 414 13F holders blows away the record. Again, it's as blowing away as that $10 billion record. The ETFs that were launched in the same month as the Bitcoin ETFs but weren't Bitcoin, we'll call them the same class of January 2024. They had like zero, two, one had 10, five. I mean, but 414 is ridiculous. If you have 20, you're like rare. It's like, oh my God, home run. So these numbers again are just like insane land. Looking at the holders, 65% are advisors. That's good. They bought it. They're going long, easy to understand. A lot of them are in Heartland America too. That's a good sign, because that is the sort of boomer who likes the golf investor. That's it. Then you've got hedge funds. Now, hedge funds were a bigger percentage than I thought they'd be. And you have, I think, half of the top 15 hedge funds were in there. I mean, big. Some of them are probably doing ARB between the Bitcoin ETF, the futures, and the spot. But that's okay, because these guys, even though ARB, and that sounds like, oh, this Wall Street, like, and it's somehow bad, all they're doing is like making tiny little monies on price differences. But what that does is it collapses the prices between all three of those things so that everybody's getting a better deal. So to me, arbitrage is kind of the magic sauce. So that way some poor schlep who buys Bitcoin on Coinbase isn't paying an outrageously higher fee than someone using the futures versus the spot. So they're in there basically arbing everything against each other to make little pennies. And that's good because it keeps prices nice and tight so that the ETF is always priced near spot. Fine. Some could be going long. You know, if you're in a macro hedge fund, this is a considered an alt probably to some people. And the ETF, they're going to appreciate because the liquidity on some of these is so big, they can't be seen. So they can go in and out of the ETF without being noticed. It's anonymous. Nobody knows who owns the ETF. So hedge funds tend to like ETFs for some reasons. So that's probably a good sign. So the fact that they're in there providing liquidity and a little like credibility is good. And then the Wisconsin one was really a surprise. I didn't think we'd see pensions or endowments for a couple 13F cycles. Those are like sailfish. Okay. So you know, these are the hardest fish to catch in the whole ocean. So the fact that Wisconsin bit so early is really good sign. Normally an ETF, you've got to get real liquid and it takes a little while. And so the fact that you have a pension, I think speaks to how liquid IBIT in particular got. It's already trading a billion a day and it did after like a couple of weeks. So that's good because again, now another pension sees it and goes, okay, I won't look like a total idiot if I buy this now. And then the next person's like, well, if Wisconsin and Michigan do it, maybe I should think about doing it. And that's how institutions work. They all sort of move in herds and they're all worried about what the next person will think. And they look for cover, just how it is. I wrote a book called The Institutional ETF Toolbox, and they don't want to stand out at the parties they go to. It's very, it's like high school or something. I don't know. But I think that an institution would use the Bitcoin ETF just like they use GLD for portfolio completion. Even though they could get spot in other ways, the ETF, again, easy access. Nobody has to, there's no contracts. They can get in and out when they want. It's liquid enough that they're not going to move the market around. And they'll just add a little on to complete their portfolio. So they should be a decent audience for this in the future. So anyway, all told, about 15% of the Bitcoin ETF assets now is held by 13Fs. So in other words, the pros own that. The rest would be smaller advisors or retail. So I think that 15% number will grow to 30, 40% in the next year or two. And that to me would be like the perfect medium. 40% pro crowd, 60% retail. That to me would be like where a lot of the Vanguard ETFs are, where that's where SPY is. That's where like the stud ETFs end up.
So in that way, the hotel grows and you just have all these institutions staying in the hotel over a long period of time because of portfolio completion. We love that metaphor because that really explains why people own gold or put Bitcoin into their multi-asset portfolio. They have to own different things that respond to different environments. And people own Bitcoin and gold because it does provide you that portfolio allocation to a defense against the devaluation of the dollar, as you mentioned. It's the core reason to own something like that. Now, I want to push back on something you said earlier about the ETFs not being the driving force, but you mentioned just now that there's an institutional FOMO wave that's probably coming due to maybe just one pension fund in Wisconsin going long, making a disclosure. It opens the gates for others to take cover from Wisconsin. Then you maybe get some other Midwestern, then the other parts of the country join in. And all of a sudden, Bitcoin is part of this wave because maybe the trigger of the ETF. So I was wondering if you could, you know, marry those two points.
Yeah. I mean, all I'm saying is that, you know, if you are running a bunch of money and you're an asset owner and you're managing a pension, you know, you're in the public eye and your 13F is public. So you may not want to be the first one to jump in the water. You know, I get it. But the fact that Wisconsin's in there, maybe we see Texas, you know, if you look at like something like GLD, which is the gold ETF, I can tell you real quick how many pensions are in this. And we've got like, Here's Texas and Pennsylvania, right? So those are two states. They own gold. Maybe they'd be interested in owning this. So I doubt you'll see all 50 states. But like I said, I just think remember, pensions could buy Bitcoin on their own. They could have their asset manager that services them go just get crypto in some cold wallet. But again, a lot of them like GLD, and a lot of pensions like just having an ETF for certain things. For certain things, they don't want the ETF. But for something like gold or Bitcoin, it's perfect because you get in and out quickly. It's not that expensive. It's already cheap. It's just the easy, and you're not going to hire an active manager to do this. So there's no reason to have a consultant find a good Bitcoin manager. All you need is beta to Bitcoin, and the ETFs will do the job. So I could definitely see more using it, especially the liquid ones. So iBit and Fidelity to me probably are the ones that are liquid enough to attract the big institutions. Because remember, institutions come in a little bigger and they hate people knowing what they're doing because they don't want to get front run. So they need a lot of liquidity. So $1 billion a day to me would be like the ante of where they would be like considering you. And iBit's been trading $1 billion a day almost every day for the whole time. So that's why I think you could see more. But there's got to be some interest though. Like you could, like, let's take New Jersey. Maybe the guy running the New Jersey or the girl running New Jersey pension is just like, you know, I hate this. It's a scourge in society. Maybe they just feel like Elizabeth Warren, you know, just like hate it. They're not going to buy it. I mean, even if they see Wisconsin. So it's not like just because they bought it. But if you were thinking about it and debating it, it just gives you a little more cover. Same with the advisors. If a couple advisors see people going in, I think Matt Hogan put out a list that of the top 20 advisors, a good chunk were already in, Hightower in particular. That's a good sign, because then it's like, you know, you won't look that weird. And then there comes a point where it's like, well, maybe I should be in it so I don't miss out. Because then if I'm the only advisor not in it, I don't think we're anywhere near that. But that point can happen. So in my view, I think for now, all of this money is good because it's unsolicited money. It's money that like wanted Bitcoin, and they're like, call up their advisor, or the person who runs Wisconsin was clearly into it. So right now, what you have is like in tech, they call it early adopters. Right now, to me, all this money is early adopters, no matter what the player type is. But you need a good chunk of early adopters to get the ball rolling. So that's all that's happening. In advisory space, at some point soon, they're going to start being able to solicit it, meaning the advisor can call up a client and say, hey, you don't have to do it, but here's my pitch for this. You know, we think it could work. Right now, they're not doing that. They're only if the client calls them and says, I have to get in. So as unsolicited rolls out, that could also, you know, be a catalyst, I think, over time. So, you know, we'll see. A big gigantic correction is a variable here that could spook people for a little while. So I do think that, and there's also traders. People are going to trade this. They're going to trade it, and people who do trend investing, they might jump in to ride the trend, but if the trend bails, they'll bail. That's why I do think you're going to see outflows correlate with price to a degree. But remember, these outflows in and out are only 1-2% of the assets. So again, picture this is just the lobby doing bustling lobby things, people coming in, people coming out. The key is just focus on the hotel and how many people are up in the rooms. That's what you want to focus on versus like the bustling lobby. And over time, I think the hotel should grow.
Eric Balchunas, senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg. Thank you so much for joining us once again, giving us your insights into the Bitcoin ETF ecosystem. Please tell people where they can find you and your work online.
Sure. At Eric Balchunas on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, or I have a podcast called Trillions, which you can get anywhere, Spotify. And I'll just leave it at that. Those are two places to get me, no cost.
Excellent. And don't forget to check out Eric's books as well. Thank you, Eric, and we'll catch you guys next time.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by River. River.com/TBL for that special offer. And the reason that we love River at the Bitcoin Layer is that they put your education first. River.com/learn to understand what Bitcoin is, the fundamentals. Also, how to get your Bitcoin off the exchange into your own custody solution. You can use river.com/learn for all of that information. Go check them out today.